Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Robert Brown, a Scottish botanist from 1780 to 1830, around about his life was then. Very famous. Most people know of him, or his link to the common day is Brownian motion. And if you study a bit of science, the link is that he discovered the nucleus of cells and began to see something called organelles, little organs inside cells. So cells weren't just blobs, they had little organs and little parts to themselves. We're going to talk about him, and the interesting aspect here is the many layers of varnish you'd like to see in his story. So I'm going to go through my story of him, what I knew, a bit about his actual life, different aspects to his life, and a bit about Brownian motion. And as you'll listen to it, you'll hear different layers of varnish, and the idea is to actually see how the different parts stick together, and you may have your own story, how it links together. So my story starts off with Robert Brown. I remember distinctly in the science room at, there was an older house classroom at the science block at my primary school. And he went across, and we talked about Brownian motion, and this English pastor who was a father, he was a priest, and he used to look down his microscope, and one day he saw something jiggle, a little piece of pepper jiggle his microscope, and he penned a letter to someone and became known as the famous for Brownian motion. He wrote a message, and people around the world questioned this. Of course, this story was rather hypocritical, and thinking back about it, I think the science teacher got the Brown the botanist confused with the popular fiction of Father Brown. So he got those two images together, housed together, shipped it off, and that was my sort of misconception for a long time. I heard of Brownian motion from time to time, actually modelled it on a little TRS-80. That's where the steps and the size of the steps were controlled by random numbers, and I had this little particle move around the place. So Brownian motion is for a tiny little object being buffeted by atoms this way and that. So it's sort of like a, if you can imagine a, a ball being hit amongst a large crowd, it gets bounced about the place as different people get in to give it a bit of a thump. Sort of reminds me of, I think, a Dead Kennedys concert where he, Rob Gill Biafra put a $50 note in a beer can and threw it out into the punks, and that bounced around a place. It was the image of one person who caught it initially and then got immediately stomped on the sets, idea of random motion and Brownian motion. And then there was the famous Douglas Adam using a cup of tea as a Brownian motion generator. That's for the infinite improbability generator. And so that was there. And then studying about Einstein, he did some more studies into it and actually put some numbers into it and improved it. So that was my sort of general understanding till I had a bit of time to research a bit more deeply. My first encounter after that was this tragic story of a person called Boltzmann, a very quiet schizophrenic person who figured out thermodynamics, the laws of thermodynamics, and he was very much abused by someone called Mark M-A-C-C-H, I think, or M-A-A-C-H. I'm unfortunately dyslexic, but he comes across in he was in part of the Vienna rationalist school. That is, if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. So you can't see atoms, therefore they don't exist. Therefore, all your work is rubbish, Mr. Boltzmann. And There was a series of, I suppose, tragedies in Boltzmann's life. And so the discovery of Brownian motion, or the explanation of Brownian motion and atoms, all linked in and began to confirm. This is 1905, so we really didn't know atoms existed for sure until 1905. It's a pretty historic step forward to know that, yes, atoms do exist. They exist. 1905, that's fairly amazing. And people don't attribute the discovery or the missing link, the final jigsaw puzzle piece, which meant that, yeah, we went with that jigsaw puzzle piece with Einstein until that point in time. So the story of Boltzmann, he was really depressed, went to the United States. The US scientists were going around. Did you hear what Einstein's found? You're all proven right. But unfortunately, he was very, very depressed. And in 1906, look, I'm just going off my... I'm not checking these facts, I'm just going off the memories. And why I'm doing this podcast is to actually get all these memories ironed out and all the techniques ironed out. But 1906, Boltzmann hung himself in Trieste while his family were down at the beach. Family went back to this horrible scene. And I've heard from other sources, which aren't necessarily reliable, I'll tell you this, but there were scientists at the time who had figured out, put two and two together, and were racing to try to get Boltzmann to reassure him. And you often get these stories. And so there was Brownian motion. So Brownian motion's, for me, has got a lot of stories to it of scientific, I suppose, bullying, the actual human side of scientists coming all the way through. So that's my own personal story, looking into Brownian motion. And one of the things, you're primed to observe Brownian motion, and can I say I have never observed anything which I could say definitively was Brownian motion. I can see chemicals diffuse into each other, and I can model it with Brownian motion, but I haven't actually observed Brownian motion. And furthermore, I've also looked at the Millikan's oil drop experiment, where you get a very tiny oil drop and suspend it in a field, and these are really small oil droplets, and you look at it in a field, and those oil droplets are sufficiently large that you don't see Brownian, or they're sufficiently large, you're seeing the oil droplet suspended by a single electric charge and electric field. You're measuring the charge on a single electron, the force and charge on a single electron. And you do bulk calculations, Reynolds numbers of it, actually how fast an oil droplet of different radii fall through gas, thick gas. And so, look, you definitely don't see it. The oil droplets jiggle around the place. They look pretty solid. In fact, almost every optical microscope I've looked down at every feature in liquids and stuff like that. I myself haven't seen Brownian motion, and I think if anyone actually did see it, they would actually call it out. Now, of course, as you'll hear, there's Brownian motion. Robert Brown wasn't a pastor in a little village who had an amateur view on telescopes. He didn't buy a microscope and decided he wasn't necessarily a gentleman scientist. He was more closer to professional science, a natural philosopher. So the overall view is there. But I'm just putting it there, out there, that I myself haven't seen the Brownian motion of Robert Brown. And we'll, in a little further in this podcast, we'll get into a discussion of it. It is important that the fact that I haven't seen it, and I would pick it up, that when when a quick look through the Wikipedia, as you do, Wikipedia article to check if there's any new ideas. A new idea put forward in Wikipedia is that Brownian motion was observed in ancient times. They had an ancient scientific poem. Of course, scientific poem immediately has got me interested on so many different levels. Partly because the people at the time of Newton and Descartes used to open up their books with a piece of poetry. And this is, of course, and in Latin, so it would be actually quite interesting to read in dedications. There was a whole lot of flourish. And so this scientific poem was just amazing. And I've read a fair amount of Latin scripts, and for some reason I miss these rather banal bits of this thing in Wikipedia, a description of, to me, this is tiny little dust particles stuck in when your eyes are dark adapted light streams across it, but does not impede in the room. The only thing emitting light is the little dust particles, and you can actually see the dust particles sit in the air, and it's actually quite a nice sort of contemplative things occasionally when you do see dust particles in a room and see this phenomenon of these little dust particles floating and whirring around in the currents and sort of just sitting there. You can see that sort of thing actually in your eye. You get little blood cells go into the vitreous humor in your eye, and you can look up in, on a very dark background which doesn't give your retina any clues to what's going on. You can actually see diffraction patterns of these little particles floating. They're called floaters in your eyes, and there's floaters outside there. And I must admit, when I saw it, I didn't see any Brownian motion. And although this this reference in Wikipedia has a fairly good, stunningly good explanation of what Brownian motion would be and why they're there, it's really questionable. So I think we can go against what my science teacher said. I think it was Nigel Cordell from Sri Lanka. It was some other chap there, but the idea that Robert Brown was a Father Brown, no, that's not correct. And I put rather doubt that we knew about Brownian motion in ancient times, but it is true, definitely true, that Brownian motion had many fathers, but Brown was the sort of English one who got named, and Einstein was the answerer, and it had a huge impact in steering us away from this quite suffocating scientific movement. I'll have to think, it's called the Vienna School. I must admit, I really disliked it because Boltzmann's my hero. I rather like Boltzmann. I like his gentle, he's always a very gentle person to read through. And so anyone who's bullying him and the institutional bullying that was happening in the scientific world at that time, as you read into it, so you get the glossy magazine view, and then as you read into the letters and various back and forth of these various people, you get a view of a whole lot of scientific bullying and going on. Various people were bullying and overbearing personalities as you come. Of course, we get a very soap opera view of it. All the actuality is a bit different. So we've talked about that. We've talked about what Brownian motion is. Brownian motion is the buffeting of very tiny particles, almost atomic-sized particles, by interaction with the particles around the outside. And I must admit, thinking about it, I might go back and check Einstein's calculations on it. That would be an interesting aspect of it. I suppose I must admit that people who say, oh, look, Einstein in the miraculous year of 1905 had a hat trick of Brownian motion, photoelectric effect, and special relativity. I think they're not seeing the new methodology, new thinking methodology that Einstein was developing. His new approaching scientific experiments as a system, his systems at level of thinking. I don't think people see that. They're sort of looking at the individual experiments and are not very critical. They see that he's made a conclusion based on these results, which he's not taking completely seriously. Yet these people fall into taking some of his results extremely seriously. We'll have to go there on another podcast. So it's a Brown's there. So we've got what Brown in motion is, and we've got the fact that the other big discovery is the nucleus of a cell. He actually, Brown observed Brown in motion, documented it, got it into the in as a as something on the sidelines into the scientific arena, the pantheon of unexplained results hanging out there, and he also discovered the nucleus, and so that was key to developing cell theory. People got the general basis of the cell, and then the nucleus came forward. Now, the assumption that all cells have nucleuses turns out to be incorrect. There's bacteria and archaea cells, which are cells without nucleus. Now, this is a key thing. So let's get to know Robert Brown more directly. I'm going to go on several streams through his life. One is the overview of his career. And I'm pretty amazed that I'm saying this because I've done a podcast. I didn't like it. I'm doing a second podcast and just sleeping at it without thinking of going across. So one stream of his career is him, what he actually did. And then I'm going to go another stream to actually really talk in detail about his journey around Australia, and another in real detail about his discovery of Brown in motion. So his career in general, Scottish, born in Scotland, went to Northern Ireland as a surgeon's mate. And as so often in these things, if you almost read everything, the military is a major, the military and the clergy are things where the finance comes along, and these people with the passion that don't have the pressure on them, and they can actually go out and think. And so he went out and began to explore the botany of Northern Ireland and collect, I think, different grasses. And grass is a really important aspect of it. Grasses and other small flowering things. And he made great contributions to that in the Northern Ireland regiment. Became famous among Irish botanists. Sort of botany is sort of the thing that you would, if you were a natural philosopher and you wanted to study nature. Nature, their idea was arboreal trees. They had a sort of a romantic view of nature. So you naturally studied plants. The one great thing is that they can't run away. They're there, and they can sit there, and you can actually bring them back and grow other ones. It's a great thing about them. And he got picked up, and we'll do the voyage around Australia a bit more. But he got picked up by Sir Joseph Banks. So he's Joseph Banks is the sort of premier mega botanist of his age. So he was pretty much, if you had to think of someone nowadays who's like Joseph Banks, it would be possibly, in my book, Elon Musk. He was someone who would just talk about possibilities. So he was into space tourism, not in his age. Space tourism, the spaceship of the age, was the Captain's Cook ship Endeavour, and he bought his way onto that as a botanist and collected samples and really went into it. But it was a powerful man with heaps of money and connection. I was able to actually work with the Admiralty. Now, the Admiralty had sort of strategic military ideas, but he was able to translate a lot of the ideas to the Admiralty in ways that made sense to them. So he was able to so first off, he went with the trip around Australia, and the reason was the trip around Australia was the voyage discovery trip to Australia was to use the computed star positions which Captain Cook, who was an ace astronomer, used to actually basically get GPS accuracy. I say GPS accuracy, he could actually locate the position of the ship Endeavour, and he'd have to correct for the fact whether he's on the top deck or bottom deck. We're talking about 10 meter accuracy some of the time, 100 meter accuracy, and so he produced incredible GPS scale maps of New Zealand, the coast of Australia, and Hawaii, and also they looked at the transit of Venus. This is the Banks story, and that was a sort of similar to the space race. The space race at the end of the around the time of the French Revolution was who can get the best transit of Venus, and so the British really nailed that. And it's important to know that the British sent off different grades of research ships. So the Endeavour was the top grade, a ship. 3 years after, so ships go into their sweet spot. It's a bit like buying a new car. When you buy a new car, things go wrong pretty quickly, and then they've got a sweet spot, and then it gets a bit crappy, and then you sell it on. So that's an important thing to know. So Banks, really powerful, important person. Again, the best thing you can possibly do is read the diaries of Cook and read the diaries of Banks and the history. So Banks, England, Banks, Joseph Banks, chief botanist, Elon Musk of his age, had the ear of the government, the ear of the people followed him, read his books, were fascinated by his world. He was sort of like a superstar. And so he so we'll go back onto the actual voyages, but he put Brown on a voyage around Australia, and he actually circumnavigated Australia. We'll come back to that. Named a fair swag of Australian plants, South African plants and stuff like that, and he came back, and he was a chief sort of scientific botanist in Britain, and that's his career, he returned to be something high up in the Royal Society or some aspect of the Botanic Gardens, and wrote papers and died. That's not a great thing to do, but he did look at things under the a large number of plant samples underneath the best microscopes of the age. And this is not just a country father who's bought a cheap microscope. And so he's looked at it, and there are certain, he's got enough samples that he's, if there's a plant sample he's going to see, he will see a nucleus. He's looking at enough, so he sees these little programming things in the centre of cells, and he calls them a nucleus. And so he's famous in cell theory. So majority of plant cells you cannot see the nucleus in, but he saw it in certain times. I must admit, I haven't read exactly what plant cell he did see, but I did read a report, and again, when I'm reading these things, I'm saying, oh gosh, I'm going to do a podcast in so many years' time, I'll put that aside and file it. So this is filed off in the deep, dark recesses, and it may not be true. And this is where I got confused. I got confused about a number of things, because there was talk for an expedition out to beyond the British territories in North America into Kansas, and he picked up certain flowers in Kansas, and these flowers in Kansas were such that when the seeds dried, they exploded, leaving their organelles. These are tiny little mitochondria, these other things which happen to be very easy to see, and when he looked at those organelles of this particular seed from the Kansas expedition, he saw Brownian motion. So you and I can't see Brownian motion. It's only if you get these, if you can see things small enough through Brownian motion. I must admit, I'll go onto the internet now and see if I can see microscope slides of Brownian motions definitively. I must admit, I know people who've put micro nanospheres of polystyrene, I think they are, to do with nanotechnology. I think this is definitely a problem down there. And so that's an important point. Now, reading back, so I had automatically assumed that he'd also gone on expeditions to North America, but reading his life history again, that's not there. Someone else must have done it and sent it with the seeds. So let's get back to that covers his discovery of the nucleus, discovery of Brownian motion, what Brownian motion is, the theories, the internet sort of theory that Brownian motion is discovered from ancient times. and described. I think it's more like that's almost like noise coming through. I think it's a good, correct explanation, but it wasn't an observation with the explanation linked together. So he Brown had a definite explanation of something that he could see. These things used to not sit still. The smallest particles used to move around in this microscope. And so Brown in motion, observe Brown in motion, and observe the nucleus. These are the key things. Now let's get back to his voyage around Australia. And this is also my great, great, great confusion. To go to voyage to Australia, we have to you have to remember about banks, because people used to go and report to banks, because he was the Elon Musk, the key that would convert science into military strategy, political strategy, and get finance together to put these things together. So we're going to have to talk about that and go further back. There was so there's a strait. So if you look at the map of Australia, there's in the bottom of Australia is a southern city called Melbourne in Victoria, and then beneath that southern city is Tasmania. And so Tasmania originally was Dutch. There you go. It's called Van Diemen's Land, and I don't think the Dutch, they have this formal thing where you have to claim a land, and I don't think we'll ever really know. So the Dutch had mapped a lot of Australia, and they had been at Perth, and then they had been Rottnest Island. Yeah, Rottnest is Dutch for Rat Island, because you had the small marsupials, which were rat. Then they'd sort of avoided that and went up to Indonesia. Now you've got to remember that Dutch, these a whole series of bubble economies. So the Portuguese owned Indonesia, and their economy, their bubble burst for a number of reasons. They lost various kings at sea. They had fires of Lisbon, earthquakes, tsunamis, all things happened to. I really don't know the actual structure there. But then the Dutch Empire expanded very quickly, but expanded into the decaying Portuguese Empire. So there's actually one island in Indonesia which is still Portuguese, a sort of well-established fort. And then there's Jakarta, which was the Dutch city. So Jakarta's still got a Dutch flavour to it. It's an Indonesian city, but it's still got Dutch canals for some reason. We won't go into it. And it's also interesting how the Dutch got into canals as well. Why they got into canals. But so the Dutch were there, and so it was strategically important that Tasmania was separate from Australia, so that they discovered Flinders and Bass in basic whaling boats. And there's whaling is a history, has a very strong history in Australia, and Americans coming to Australia is whaling. It's an incredibly important part of history, but because we don't like whaling, we have to just wipe that out. So Bass and Flinders explore and find this strait of water between Tasmania and Australia. And so it's important in that it means that the British possession of Australia is it's required several steps. It required terra nullius, it required a possession, raising of flags and proclamations to go across. I think the proclamation of Australia, the First Fleet happened on not on Australia Day, but the proclamation happened in a few weeks later in February. Again, people just don't read through it. So this Bass and Flinders. So there are two people. Remember Bass and Flinders. Bass is named after Bass Strait. That's this big channel of water, proving that Tasmania was an island. They didn't know that Tasmania was an island. And in the Ice Ages, Tasmania wasn't an island. So the Aborigines just walked across from Melbourne to Hobart, basically, and then the sea level Rose again, and you can imagine a Bass Strait can be quite a stormy place, sort of shallow water. The big southern roaring Arctic currents go through there. Yeah, so the biggest, some of the biggest waves on Earth hit the east, the west coast of Tasmania. So that can be quite a frightening place there. It's still quite remote, the west coast, west Tasmania is quite an isolated place still. So there's bass there, and the story of bass, it's a bit of a head scratcher, but he gets captured by South American pirates, I suppose, and spends his life working, the last days of his life working as a slave in a tin mine in South America. There you go. Flinders. So Flinders is important because he's going to be the captain, which looks after Robert Brown. So Flinders makes his way back to England, talks to Banks, and Banks listens to him and says, "Look, we really want to get another scientific expedition out here. Why don't we actually find where there are what the actual structure of Australia is? We know a few bits, but is it multiple islands or is it just one big blob?" And it turns out to be one big blob. Why Admiralty? Well, it's important for sovereignty, and does the claim, does if I plant the flag in Sydney, how far does it reach? Because if there's a big strait here, we're going to have to do several missions here. And so they said, "Okay, well, you can go down, Flinders, you can go down to Australia, and your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to circumnavigate Australia and check out if there's different islands." And so this is why you can sort of see, like, Sydney is actually a secret city. Like, there's lots of secrets in Sydney. Like, if you're travelling up the coast of Australia, the gates to Sydney is just incredibly small. The heads, it's a sort of like a secret inlet. So there's lots of secret inlets and lots of secrets in Australia, the way it was. So the idea was, oh, we didn't know this bloody big strait here in Bass Strait. Perhaps we will see other straits. So you can go down. Now, it's a bit different, though they're able to wing for a high-profile coast, the Endeavour. They winged this pretty questionable boat, which had sort of passed its prime. So there was an understanding, British shipbuilding is that you build ships, and after 3 years, they're really crew, you've got a great crew, and they're a great warship. And then after that, they sort of become a bit unseaworthy, and then you try and sell them off to private industry. So that was a case. And essentially, there's a 7 years war against France and Britain. Basically, just the way it was won was a bit like churning up the shipbuilding. Britain was a great shipbuilder, and of course, in the shipbuilding, they knew what they were doing, and the Investigator was the ship that was going to take Brown to Australia, and he would circumnavigate Brown. It's important to know that this ship wasn't like the Endeavour, it wasn't a cargo ship. Well, we think it's a cargo ship. From as far as the British were concerned, it was a state-of-the-art exploration ship with huge supply holds, so this ship could last months at sea without docking, getting resupplied, and it had all provisions on it. It had everything. It sort of like a, it was like an aircraft carrier, the Endeavour, even though we would think of it sort of like two or three, four buses. It's the sort of size, to get your idea for in terms of scale of the Endeavour. I can't describe it. Like, it's definitely not much bigger than a suburban block out here in Australia. The Endeavour's a pretty tiny ship, but if you got to go back. So the Investigator, which was called the Xenophon, I think. I'm just really, I only remember that because we have a politician called Xenophon out here. So it was rather strange. I really have to work out what the Xenophon meant. It was called Rebadged the Investigator. And it was a sort of fairly old ship, and that's an important thing. It went with Brown and various people, and Brown started to go with Flinders, and Flinders basically went through around through Sydney, mapped Melbourne and that type of stuff, Phillip Bay, Soil Hills at Geelong. So there's the Yu Yangs. So the heaps of things in Australia. Flinders Ranges. You could see the Flinders Ranges from the coast. Went up there. There's some absolutely wild, like it's Adelaide. It's sort of coming across. There's Adelaide, which is on the Melbourne side of the coast. Then there's this sort of like a lake of Italy going down, which is Port Pirie. And there's also another peninsula coming down, I can't pronounce it. They're pretty fantastic. And look, these are just the most wild. And there's Kangaroo Island. I think Flinders circumnavigated Kangaroo Island. All this area here. This is pretty wild and beautiful place. I just can't describe the beauty of these places. So there's heaps of, or when I was there was heaps of bird life. You'd bushwalk and there'd be these unusual, really unusual plants. And of course Brown had a field day. The one unusual plant I've seen, I'm still questioning, is called the desert watermelon. So you're out in the desert, the distance here, and you go along and there's this green watermelon sitting there. And I'm only saying I didn't dream it. I was with this group, this bushwalking group, and I was just told, oh, you can't eat that, it's poisonous, right? And you just went on, and we went, you know, there's just so many fascinating things out there. I never saw it again. Sort of decaying military facilities all the way out there. It's just a fantastic place. But the point that we want to know is that Flinders began after you sort of reached, I think by the time you reached Perth, he was really running out of luck, but he lost 6 crew members at Cape Catastrophe. That's why it's called Cape Catastrophe. And when you're flying from Perth to Perth to Melbourne, you can look out the plane and see these islands, and the Great Australian Bight. There's fantastic plants, the Nullarbor plants, heaps of that stuff. So around Perth, going up the western coast, it's pretty treacherous waters all around Australia, and the ship began to fall apart. Sorry, just got interrupted there, but yeah, this is the trail end of a podcast. You've got the interesting thing about Brown. Oh, there's some more interesting stuff coming up. So the idea is the Endeavour's not such a great ship. It's not a big acceleration ship like the Endeavour. And this is 1805, 1810. I don't have the dates in front of me, but I do have dates in my head. So the first fleet was 1788, so that was just a basket case for about 10 years or more. And so that's all going through my head. There's the Rum Rebellion. They had to really, the US was quite influential in Australia. Australians don't quite understand how. But Flinders was also came out to the area with Bligh. So it's the Rum Rebellion. They sent a few more high-quality people out. Now, the important thing is to understand that Britain had their interests sort of spread fighting the French. The glamour place was Africa. Australia was really where you had a whole of also-run people come out in terms of quality of people, quality of administrators. They had sent up one good administrator, but it led to an interesting set of problem solving here. So Brown went out, and I'll have to tell a story on another podcast about this famous cat. Flinders has a really famous cat. So Flinders goes across, so his ship's in tatters. Brown's has got happy as Larry. It's got all heaps of samples from around Australia. And it goes to Timor, which is the Portuguese colony, up in Dutch, East Indies. Remember that Holland owned it, but it was really a company owned it, a bit like Rhodesia was owned by a company, not by a national group. And there was a corporate structure. So they went to Timor, and Timor was a pretty famous place in terms of various English ships docking there. And it's also interesting that Timor was there's a large population of black Africans in Timor because they were the slave descendants of slaves brought up there or to garrison the Timor forts. And so they make it back to they hobble back to Sydney, and they condemn the investigator, and so Brown leaves the two things, and you can imagine my absolute confusion. You just get your head around this. So Brown does a whole lot of expeditions up here into the Blue Mountains, up the Hunter River, the Hunter Valley, all this around here, up here in Aussie land. Goes down to Tasmania and does a huge amount of, I forget what it's called. We call it Mount Wellington after the Duke of Wellington. But is it called another mountain at the back of Hobart? Does a whole lot of Hobart, the river systems up around there. Collects huge numbers of samples and packs. Now at this time, there's a Flinders is going returning back to Britain. Now you can imagine my confusion here. So I'll say it here that he goes back on the Porpoise, and then the Porpoise crashes and sinks and loses some of Banks's samples, and then not Banks's samples, Brown's samples. So a lot of flowers out here have got Brown in their name after this particular botanist. So that's an important aspect. And so now Flinders, oh, there's so much stories to Flinders. There's a cat, there's his bowel cancer, which is going for years and years, and so he's this person obsessed with his poo, and eventually dies of bowel cancer. So it's really interesting to read about. And then there's the romance, where he gets married, delayed. They can spend a bit of time together. And the wife, I believe, the wife goes out with him in the ship, and the people find out that you can't go with your wife. You can't. That's unheard of. And they take her off the ship, and they have to say goodbye. And this is interesting. So Flinders is doing this tour of Australia, trying to get back to his wife. So he gets on another ship, the Sea something in my head. And that ship has a trunk in it with instructions from the New South Wales government to the British government, letters. And that's an important aspect. So Flinders docks in at Mauritius, which is a French island off the coast of Africa, in the Indian Ocean. Been to Mauritius. And it's the home of the dodo. It's got several islands with it. It's quite an interesting little place. And I know people who have come from Mauritius. Okay, so he gets there. Now, the entire thing is that science at the age of enlightenment was considered above war. And so you could have something called a scientific passport. So, specifically, I don't think it's mentioned in the American Constitution, but Benjamin Franklin tried to instruct the US people that if it's a scientific ship, you must leave it alone. And so he had written specific orders to all US ships not to attack British ships, or not to attack Cook, Captain Cook, who was still going on voyages around the place after the Civil War, this type of thing. So Flinders rocked up and said, "Oh, I've got this ship. Can you look after it?" So even if you're warring and you've got a scientific ship, you would actually look after the scientific ship, give it safe passage and all this type of stuff. So you definitely wouldn't do anything. You'd have marines, but not necessarily cannons on a scientific ship. You can have troops on the ship for it. So the British sent troops with their exploration ships, or some of their exploration ships. I don't think they sent troops. Oh, yeah, they must have sent troops in the investigators, because the investigator had one or two cannons, sort of a few, nothing really special on it. And so they said, "Oh well, okay, we'll search the ship." They searched the ship. They found this trunk. Opened the trunk. The trunk was full of correspondence. And they said, "No, well, your scientific passport doesn't work." And they kept Flinders on the ship for 7 years. So here's myself thinking, "Oh, they've kept Flinders and the ship for 7 years. What's going on?" So how does Brown, who's with Flinders, do it? But the thing is that Flinders was going back separate to Brown. So they kept him for 7 years, and the British and the French sent letters to the governor of Mauritius, who ignored them, and he's still like keeping him as prisoner for some reason. So they kept him for 7 years, and he just got back to spend a few weeks with his wife and daughter. I don't know how this works, daughter. Before he died. It's one of these great sort of nail-biting stories, and there's a whole heap of stories there. But let's go back here. So Brown's gone around Australia, collected... So he's one of our greatest botanists. So as Banks did Botany Bay, like he did one or two things, Brown's is the, sort of the biggest botanist in Australia, and discovery of Browning motion and the nucleus of cells. And so he's lost some of his samples. What happens is that they refit, they fix, no worries, mate, we'll get that ship ready for you. And they do an Aussie job on it. And they, I think largely due to American designs, they recast the sails of the American ships. It's a square rigger, different sail designs, it'll go faster. And so they bodged it out and said, "On you, mate. Thanks, Browno." And they put him up there with his samples in this ship called the Investigator. It's still called the Investigator, but it's a new look ship. It's sort of turbocharged sails. And you can instantly recognise these sails. You recognise them as they're the type of sails in the 18th century, sorry, the 19th century versus 18th century. It's really easy to recognise the different sail configuration. It's really obvious once you look at it. So Brown got back, but a lot of his samples were waterlogged because the ship was basically sinking as it was getting back, and it just limped into Plymouth. And then they condemned it again. We may as well go through the investigation. And then Brown continued his life and didn't. Then this is 1810, had another 20, 30 years where he did all his work. That's following the ship. We'll just finish off the ship, what happened with the ship. They're about to just wreck the ship, and they found a punter to buy it. And he looked after the ship, and it lasted another up to 1870. It went back. This is a great thing about Wikipedia. You can say, "Oh, I want to study this ship." So it lasted a long time as a wooden sailing ship, 1870s. And this, is really, really interesting. So my mother's relatives was into Irish shipping, and you think, "Oh, this is famous," but everyone was into shipping back then. So it's interesting to know about the wooden shipping and the steam shipping and stuff like that. And so there you've got the story of Brown. And my absolute confusion was that Brown went out on the Investigator and came back on the Investigator. And so you automatically, as you're reading that, you say, "Okay, he's done that." And then you look at Flinders and you say, "Well, you'd automatically think that Flinders, being the captain of the Investigator coming out, would be also the captain of the Investigator going back." But that wasn't the case. And so you've got the botanist keeping on the Investigator, and Flinders and just having a relatively straightforward go to Australia, circumnavigate it, hang around while the ship gets rebuilt, and then comes back on the rebuilt ship. Whereas, it's just one sort of timeline, and Flinders is another time Flinders and his cat called Trim has Trim, T-R-I-M, a famous cat with a little white star, the most famous cat, I'd say. I'd put it out there as the most famous super cat in history. I'll have to do something about Trim later on. It's worthwhile saying. Comes out. And so you can see those two different stories. The stories of Brown and the investigator, and Flinders having a much more torturous, horrible life. You know, it's sort of hard to actually get your mind around it. And of course, Flinders is now famous in Australia because Brown's famous in Australia because a lot of plants have got the word brown in them. And Flinders is famous in Australia because if you stand on basically anything which is tall on the coast of southern Australia, it's first been seen by Flinders. In fact, I think, or there's the Flinders Ranges and a whole heap of stuff, and it's part of the mythology of it all. So this could be nothing further from the truth than someone in an Australian classroom getting the view that Brown was indeed Father Brown. And there's an element of history, and it really gets into it to looking at scientific history, how it's all mixed and woven together. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.